never knew it to fail, Eva said, and came along unwillingly with Bo and Elsa. Walking on the other side from Eva, Bo took Elsa's elbow and squeezed it, and glancing up, she saw the glow that had been in his narrowed eyes all during lunch. When he was excited or interested, she noticed the cool blue-gray warmed in his pupils, and his square, almost expressionless face became lively and changeful. She remembered what Judd had said in the elevator the other day, and was trying to see evidences of it in his face when she caught herself. She was just an ignorant Norsky girl from the sticks. He wasn't crazy about her. He couldn't be. All the same, when his turn came up and she watched him go down alone to stand in the lonely focal point between spectators and traps and break 25 straight, holding his fire sometimes until she almost yelled for him to shoot, but always shooting in time, picking off the birds close to the water when their swift flight had slowed in the drop. When she watched him like an infallible machine scatter the clay saucers one after another, she held her breath and felt something like a prayer on every shot. When his gun missed fire on the 22nd bird, she was in an agony for fear it counted against him, for fear it would make him nervous as the bad bird had in the first round. But they gave him another, and he broke it, and then the last three. He came back with his face as expressionless as if he had just been for a drink of water, and when she clapped her hands, he pulled down the corners of his mouth. "Lucky," he said. "I'll probably miss a dozen next round." But his eyes did not think he would. They told her privately that he was going out there and score another possible. The last three men finished shooting, and the referee called out the running scores. Olson, 73. Mason, 73. Carter, 73. Gulbranson and Smith, 71.
"Tied for first," Elsa said.
He just rubbed his shoulder, pounded sore by the kick of the gun, and kept his eye on the shooter coming up.
"I wonder where that Judd is,"
Eva said. She had hardly said a word in the hour and a half they had been sitting there. She twisted and fidgeted, looking through the crowd.
"I'm going to look for him," she said. "He gets gabbing and never thinks what time it is."
Bo paid no attention to her words or her departure. He sprawled back, watching Olsen shoot. His actions were faster than in previous rounds. They had to be. The birds came at sharp angles, from unexpected traps, and almost every shot was a quartering one. He ran nine, snapped a hurried side shot at a saucer spinning wide from the fifth trap. A tiny fragment zinged from the clay, its click coming back after the roar of the gun. The bird fell solidly into the water. "Lost bird," the referee droned. Olsen, red in the face, protested, but the official waved him back. "Dusted target is no bird," he said. The hustler was coming through. "Condon up, Mason on deck, Williams in the hole." "All right, honey," Bo said softly. "Hold your right ear and pray." He went down early, sitting at the official table while Condon shot, and when Condon was through, he went out and shot another possible. Shoot. Relax, shoot, relax. Break the breech and kick the smoking shells out on the ground. Reload, shoot, relax. Snap up the barrels. Find the spinning disc in the split second of its rise, hands and eyes working together surely, impeccably. When he reached 20 without a miss, Elsa was on her knees. When he broke the last bird, hissing out at a high angle, she was on her feet.
"Harder they get, the easier they are for that guy," a man next to her said.
She nodded, waiting for Bo to come back.
"You did it," she said. "Bo, it was wonderful."
His eyes were warm and intimate, his voice a purr.
"I had something to shoot for," he said.
He took her hand and sat down beside her while the last two unimportant shooters finished out their rounds. Then they were calling Bo Mason back to the table, and a man was standing, bellowing through a megaphone.
"The winner, Harry Mason of Hardanger, singles champion of North Dakota. Harry Mason wins the $50 cash prize and the silver cup with a score of 98. That's shooting, folks. Give him a hand."
He dropped the megaphone to clap. Stopped that to pump Bo's hand. The crowd clapped and cheered. The representative of a sporting goods house was introduced and presented Bo with a shiny new repeating shotgun. Bo made a play of trying it out, winced and staggered when the butt touched his shoulder. The crowd laughed. Elsa saw that they liked him. Men went up to talk to him, and he was still speaking over his shoulder as he walked up the slope. Behind him, the referee was shouting, "Runner-up, Bill Olson of Mandan! Bill Olson!"
"Well, we go," Bo said.
He held a gun under each arm, a packet of new bills in one hand. "This dole burned my pocket out."
"Anywhere," she said. "Bo, I think it's wonderful."
"You do?"
"Well, some ways."
They laughed. "Where's Eva, do you suppose?" Elsa stopped.
"My goodness, we'll never find her in this crowd."
"Serve her right," Bo said. "Judd told her where to stay."
"But where can Judd be?"
"Judd? Judd's in a poker game."
"Is that—"
"He'd be a sucker to pass up a carnival like this. We probably won't see him till late."
It wasn't very nice of Judd, Elsa thought, as Bo dragged her off exuberantly toward the fair. If he was going to do that, what did he bring her for at all? They deposited the guns in the headquarters tent for safekeeping. And 3/4 of an hour later they found Eva disconsolately eating Norwegian cakes and trying to make conversation with the booth attendant, a plump, rosy Norwegian woman who spoke only 12 words of English.
"I got hungry," Eva said, "and I lost all my money on that horse race thing, and Judd isn't anywhere around. I looked all over. If they weren't giving these cakes away free, I'd be starved by now, for all he cares."
The Norwegian woman pressed Kringler and cups of coffee on them. They ate and licked their fingers.
"Mange takk,"
Elsa said to the woman, and smiled at her. The 3 of them went down the street.
"Bo won," Elsa said. "Did you know that? He's champion of North Dakota."
"That's fine," Eva said. Her eyes were roving among the passing people. She stumbled on her skirts and flew into a vixenish rage.
"That's fine," she said. "Maybe you can shoot that big fool of a Judd for me when we find him."
"Hell with him," Bo said. He winked at Elsa. "Let's go have some fun." They bought a bag of sunflower seeds from a Russian huckster and were experimentally trying out the peanut-like taste when the Ferris wheel loomed in front of them. Bo hustled them into a swinging chair. Eva squealed as the wheel began to climb, carrying them up over the trees, over the fungus growth of colored tents. The sun, which had just been down when they got aboard, showed like a thin red plate on the horizon. They reached the zenith, and the bottom dropped out of Elsa's stomach as they rolled down into the shadow.
"How do you like it?" Bo said.
"Wonderful," she said. "It's like flying."
"Let's go around again."
They went around 3 times more until the thrill was worn off it. Eva declined. From the rising, swing-like seat, climbing toward 12 o'clock position, Elsa saw her below in the edge of the crowd with her head turning right and left in search of Judd. She felt sorry for Eva, such a frivolous, helpless, selfish thing. She must feel awful being left that way. But when they climbed out after their 4th ride, Judd was there.
"Uh-oh," Bo said. "Now we'll have to referee a fight."
"I don't care," Eva was saying violently. "You said you'd be back in a little while, and I waited hours. If there was any other way of getting home, I'd go right now. I'd have gone hours ago."
"I'm sorry," Judd said. "I got detained. That was a pretty big deal Joe had up his sleeve. Turned out I made some money on it."
"What sort of deal?"
"You wouldn't understand it, Bertie," Judd said. "Business." He put his arm down around Eva's shoulders, and she shook it off.
"Eva got tired of watching us shoot," Bo said. "We found her a while back stuffing herself with Scandahoovian cake."
"I wouldn't have had even that if it hadn't been free," Eva said.
"Well, that's too bad, Bertie," Judd said. "Let's go find something to eat right now."
"I'm not hungry now."
"Quit your wrangling," Bo said. "Let's go see the show."
Lamps and Japanese lanterns were on down the carnival street, and crowds milled before booths and tents and tables. The nasal rigmarole of a barker stopped them before a long, narrow tent, lighted by 6 lamps that threw jigging shadows on the walls. At the end, 30 feet or so from the counter that closed the entrance, a grinning Negro face bobbed and grimaced through a hole in the back curtain, painted to represent a jungle river. The Negro's head came right out of the spread, terrific jaws of a crocodile.
"Hit the nigger in the head, get a good 10-cent cigar," the barker said. "Three balls for a dime, folks. Try your skill and accuracy. Hit the nigger baby on the head and get a handsome cane and pennant."
His lips moved over the drone of words like the lips of an ape, kissing, and he spoke on steadily through inhalation and exhalation, never varying the penetrating nasal whine. "Want a cane?" Beau said. He stepped over to the counter. "Me too," Judd said. The barker shoved over 6 balls from a pile stacked like cannonballs. He stood back, indifferent to his present customers, his eyes on the passing crowd, his lips moving over the nasal pour of sound. Beau motioned to Judd. "Go ahead, knock his head off." The black, grinning face in the crocodile's throat weaved and bobbled. The curtain billowed out and in. In the inadequate light, it was a deceptive target. Judd removed his coat and folded it on the counter. Then he wound up and threw, awkwardly, Elsa noticed, like a girl. The ball dented a deep, shadowy hole in the canvas and dropped. The grinning face opened its mouth, cackled. Then it became fixed, its mouth stretched wide, and Elsa stared. So perfect was the illusion of a succession of red, gaping mouths swallowing one another. "Take him," Beau said. "Your bird." Judd threw again. The face weaved easily sideward. "There's a percentage in favor of the house," Judd said. His big hand went clear around the third ball as he squinted, aiming. Beside him, Beau stood ready, and just as Judd let go, he snapped a quick wrist throw. The balls traveled side by side. The swivel-necked colored boy rolled away from Judd's, saw Beau's coming, rolled back. Judd's ball hit him solidly on the skull and bounced clear to the tent roof. "Got him," Judd said. His incongruously masculine bellow of laughter filled the entrance. The Negro face pulled back in, leaving the crocodile a dark, round hole for a throat. The barker stopped his bored droning and came over angrily.
"What's the idea?" he said. "You can't both peg at once."
"You never said we couldn't," Beau said. "Come across with a cane."
"I don't pay on that. You both threw at once."
Beau's neck and shoulders stiffened as he leaned over the counter. Elsa could not see his face, but she heard his voice, soft. "This guy hit the nigger on the head," he said. "You owe him a cane." Peaked and white with anger, the barker glared at him.
"Like hell."
"You aren't very smart, fella," Beau said. He raised one hand as the barker started to speak. "And I wouldn't hay Rube either."
"Tough guy, huh?" the barker said.
"No, I just like to see people pay off when they lose." After a minute, the barker threw a cane onto the counter. Beau took it, laid down his 2 remaining balls, tossed 2 dimes on top of them so that they rolled off the board, and handed the cane to Eva. Walking uncomfortably beside him, Elsa said,
"Do you suppose the Negro is hurt? Judd threw that awful hard."
He laughed. "You can't hurt a coon hitting him on the head." Almost immediately came the barker's voice.
"Try your luck, folks. Try your skill and accuracy. Hit the nigger baby on the head. Get a good 10-cent cigar."
"Beau," Elsa said.
"Huh?"
"Was it fair to throw both at once like that?"
He stared at her. "Sure. Every game in this carnival is a skin game. You got to outsmart 'em." "The percentage is always in favor of the house," Judd said. Beau took her arm and pointed. "There's a sample. Go on over and try your luck." Curiously, she crossed the street to where a small crowd had gathered around a table. A man at the table was manipulating 3 half-walnut shells so fast that she couldn't follow his fingers. Beau stooped to whisper, "This is one of the oldest skin games in the world, thimble rigger." He pressed $1 into her hand and nodded to her. "Go ahead." Elsa watched the man's hands. His mouth went constantly in an unintelligible flow of sound like a barker's at the throwing tent. Finally the hands came to rest, the shells in a neat row. A tall, gangling, hayseedy man in overalls threw down a silver dollar and put his finger on one shell.
"Follered her all the way," he said.
He turned the shell over, and the pea was there.
"Can't win all the time," the thimble rigger said.
He threw a dollar to the man, and his hands went intricately among the shells, caressing, touching, turning, mixing. Now and again he opened his hand and showed the pea, or raised a shell to reveal it.
"Can't win all the time. Sometimes a quick eye beats a quick hand. Down with your bets, folks. Nothing up the sleeve, an open game of skill. Try your luck again, mister."
The gangling man grinned and shook his head and stuck his $2 in his pocket.
"Shill," Beau whispered.
"What?"
"Tell you later. Go ahead and bet him."
Feeling horribly conspicuous, she stepped up and laid her dollar down. The man began shifting his shells, crooning. But she knew better than to listen to his talk. She kept her eyes on his hands, distinctly saw him put the pea under a shell and then shift the shells bewilderingly, but not so rapidly that she didn't keep her eye triumphantly on the right one. She reached out and put her finger on it. There was nothing underneath.
"But where was it?"
she said when they were walking again.
"I saw him put it there."
"Palms it in his hand," Beau said. "A clever rigger can make you think there's a pea under every one."
"But that other man won."
"He was a shill, a booster. When business is slack, he comes around and wins once in a while to keep the suckers coming."
How he could tell that the man was a shill, she had no idea. But he knew all about things like this, and she knew nothing about anything. And he was the trap-shooting champion of North Dakota. He was also very big and good-looking. She saw women turn to look at him in the street. But there was one thing she wanted to ask him until she forgot about it in the excitement of the games they played all up and down the street. If games like these were always fixed in favor of the house, then what about the poker game that Judd had been in that afternoon? Was that crooked, too? Or were poker games like that pure games of skill, where a professional gambler like Judd would naturally win? There was a great deal she didn't know, sure enough. She listened to Beau's tutoring carefully whenever he bent to tell her something in that warm, intimate voice. It was after 10 and black dark under the cottonwoods when they groped back to the team. Elsa went quietly, guided by Beau's hand, full to the chin with new experiences. She had ridden on a Ferris wheel and a merry-go-round. She had gone for a ride around a miniature racetrack in a horseless carriage, the first automobile she had ever seen, a stinking, explosive, dangerous-looking affair. She had been scared to death putting on the ulster and goggles when the man had gone behind and spun the crank and the explosion started right underneath her. She had jumped, she thought, a mile. After the dizzy whirl around the track, she had climbed out shakily and pushed up the goggles, standing laughing under the hanging lanterns, and Beau had stopped laughing suddenly and stared at her.
"God, your eyes are blue," he had said.
He was just dreadfully nice, she thought. It was his day, but it was hers, too. Everything he had done had been shared with her, as if he didn't care about winning the championship and the money unless she had it, too. She had collected cupies, canes, pennants with Devil's Lake, No Dak, across them in yellow felt. She had won a box of chocolates, eaten candy popcorn, and drunk lemonade and pop until she couldn't eat or drink any more. She had seen a show where a man in rube costume came out and sang a song about two rubes who went to a circus and got in a peck of trouble. Beau had liked that. He had stamped and clapped till the man came back and did the interminable song all over again, prancing around in his chin whiskers and straw hat and red-topped boots and bandana. Beau was singing the song himself as he helped her over the rough ground. He pulled Si's whiskers so all fired hard that his chin got as long as the neck of a gourd. All at once I see Si grin, and then I knew his troubles was at an end. And sure enough, with his knife so keen, he cut his whiskers close to his chin.
Where's it go from there?
She took a firmer hold on her plunder, each article of which she had vowed she would put away and never part with.
Something about throwing them out in a hurry?
I don't know. I don't see how you remember so much of it.
They don't get thrown out yet. Something about two girls fainting. I got it.
He sang three or four lines more.
That's wonderful, she said, genuinely impressed. I never saw such a memory.
She stubbed her toe in a root and stumbled wildly in the dark. A doll slipped from her arms and Beau fumbled for it. When he rose, his arms went around her suddenly and he kissed her. Her arms were so full of bundles that she could only twist her face away.
Wait,
she said desperately. He kept his arms around her.
Why, they're way up ahead.
Please, not now.
Don't forget, you've got to be a sport.
No welching.
I won't welch,
she said. Whatever happened, she wouldn't welch now. That was the thing he disliked Eva so for. She wasn't a sport. His low laugh stirred in her hair.
97 more, he said.
The rest of the way to the buggy she was silent, wondering how she could ever do it. 97 kisses, not in fun, not the kisses of a boy in a game, but the kisses of a man 7 or 8 or 9 years older than she was, who had been all over, and maybe had a past. And a saloon keeper, a lawbreaker, really. Briefly, as Judd's flaring match lighted a carriage lamp and the buggy emerged in the dim glow, she was reminded of the one admirer she had ever had, middle-aged, mousy old Henry Mossman, who ran the hardware store in Indian Falls, and who last spring had proposed to her at a picnic. He had sandy mustaches like a haycock, and he seemed always to smell of shoe-blacking, and he was meek, apologetic, at once gentle and ridiculous. He had proposed to her in the buggy as they drove home through the firefly-streaked darkness. The situation now was close enough to that other that she had a moment of dizziness, almost as if she were dreaming, as if she had been carried in a circle and washed up in a place and time where she had been before. But there weren't, she reminded herself, any fireflies here, and there was nothing meek or apologetic about Beau Mason. Imagine Henry Mossman working it so you had to kiss him 100 times.
What are you laughing at? Beau said.
I just thought of something.
What?
Nothing you'd care about.
I care about anything you care about.
Well, you wouldn't care about this. Judd came around and lighted the other lamp. Beau brought in the horses and hitched up.
Want me to drive? Judd said.
Sure, go ahead.
The wheels crackled through leaves and twigs as they turned into the road, leaving the calliope still wheezing and the little colored horses of the merry-go-round still rising and falling in the torchlight glare of the shore. Then hard road, the beat of trotting hoofs, the yellow blur of the carriage lamps coasting alongside, the flow of cold air around the unequal silhouettes of Judd and Eva, and the snugness as Beau tucked the buffalo robe around her feet. His arm went around her shoulders, and she did not move. She saw the shadow of Judd put an arm around the shadow of Eva, and heard the murmur of low words. Eva must be over her peeve. That was good. It would be a shame to ride all that way home, mad. It would be. Beau leaned close and kissed her, holding it a long time. She heard Eva's clothes rustle as she turned in the front seat to look back, but she did not even have the impulse to free herself. Instead, she leaned back further in the seat and smiled into the misty sky.
"Two,"
she said, so softly that the front seat couldn't hear. A long time later, when her hands were cold and her feet chilled and her lips bruised with Beau's kisses, the buggy stopped, and she saw the gable of Carl's house. She had given up her attempt to keep count and hold him to the letter of her bargain. He might have kissed her 100 or 500 times. No one made a move. Eva, muffled against Judd, squealed once in a stage whisper. Murmured words and a giggle came back, then a breathless, hushed squeak. Beau kissed her again, and when he let her go, she saw his teeth in the misty dark.
"Don't!"
Eva said from the front seat, and her shadow squirmed as if trying to get away.
Why not? Judd said, quite loud.
Because you tickle.
Isn't anybody getting off here? Judd said.
I hate to, said Elsa, and did not move. She looked at Beau, tried to make out his eyes. She pecked him with a swift kiss, pressed him back when he started to rise and help her out.
I'll just hop out and run, she said, whispering close into his ear. It was a beautiful day.
She pressed his hands, gathered her skirts, and jumped from the tire to the ground, half falling. When she popped up again, she was right beside Judd and caught his sudden movement. Eva huddled in her coat. She said good night to them and ran indoors. There was much to think about in bed, many excitements, the memory of Beau's kisses, the eagerness and frankness of his admiration when he stopped laughing beside the automobile and said, "God, your eyes are blue." He must like her. He must like her a lot. He wasn't the sort of person to pretend anything, and everything that had happened all day had said as plainly as it could be said that he was in love with her. That was a delicious thing to sleep with, a thought that could be hugged. But there was the other thought, the troublesome one, and the complete clarity with which she had seen what she had seen gave her a minute of sacred solemnity. Where was she going, and what kind of people was she going with? Because there wasn't any doubt. When she straightened up suddenly beside Judd after jumping from the buggy, he had just been pulling his hand out from under Eva's dress. Chapter 6
It isn't any of my business, Carl said. I just got this letter from Nell's. Or maybe it is my business, I don't know. I just thought I'd come and talk to you.
What's the matter? Is he scared I'll abduct his daughter?
Beau said.
I don't know that he's scared of anything special. He just wants to know who you are and what you intend to do. He's pretty pious. I suppose he just wants to make sure of you.
How do you ever hear about me in the first place?
Probably she wrote home, Carl said.
A man going out of the pool hall slapped Carl on the back, and he turned around and grinned and nodded.
In a way, I'm responsible for her, he said to Beau. Just how serious is this, anyway?
He watched Beau take out his knife and begin carefully paring his nails. The heavy-lidded eyes were somber, and the dark face expressionless. Then he looked straight up at Carl.
"Why, if you come down to that," he said, "I guess it's pretty serious."
"You mean you're going to marry her?"
"I haven't asked her," Beau said.
"But you're going to."
"I guess maybe I am," Beau said, "if I ever get up the nerve."
"I can imagine how scared you are," Carl said. "She thinks you're a little tin god on wheels."
Beau lifted his eyes again, and Carl felt the glance like something heavy, like a pressure.
"You sound as if she was making a mistake to think that," Beau said.
"If she does." Carl waved his hands helplessly. He didn't want to get into this. Nels ought to have written to Elsa or to Beau himself if he wanted to know so much. He put a man in a bad position.
"She's an awful nice kid," he said.
"I never denied that."
"But she's just a kid," Carl said. "That's the only thing that bothers me. She's never been anywhere before. She don't know much. She's just a nice-looking kid that some careless guy could take advantage of pretty easy."
"Thanks," Beau said, eyeing him.
"Thanks very much."
"I never said you were taking advantage of her," Carl said. "I just said she didn't have any experience. She's got no way of judging people, because all the people she ever saw were Norske farmers with their feet in a furrow."
"Just what is it you've got against me as her husband?" Beau said.
"I didn't say I had anything against you," Carl said.
His voice rose complainingly.
"Herrgott, I've been your friend for 6 years, haven't I? Only she isn't 19 yet. She shouldn't be rushed."
"I haven't been rushing her," Beau said. "I've been making myself stay away from her for a week."
His eyes were still cold, uncomfortably steady on Carl's face.
"Spill it," he said.
"Oh, hell," Carl said. He jingled the change in his pocket and looked toward the door,
A wind blew scraps of paper and gray dust past the windows. "How am I going to tell Nels what you do, for one thing?" he said. "I can't just write and say Bo's a good guy that runs a blind pig here in town. Nels won't like it." He shook his head. "He might even try to stop it," he said. "How would he stop it?" "He might make her come home."
"I bet you any amount of money," Bo said, "that she wouldn't go. She ran away from him once, didn't she? He's got a hell of a lot of business trying to run her now."
"Do you want to take her in to live in a room in that hotel?" Carl said. "Can you see her as the wife of a guy that runs a pig? She's just the wrong kind for you, Bo. She's cut out to have a nice house and a bunch of kids and make somebody a good wife. Your kind of life would break her heart in a year."
"Suppose I told you I'm selling the joint."
"You are?"
"I might."
"Then what would you do?"
"I've been looking over a hotel in Grand Forks," Bo said, "if that's any of your business."
Carl wrinkled his forehead.
"I don't want you to get sore at me," he said. "If I was doing the marrying, I'd just as soon marry you. But I don't know that Elsa should. By God, if I do, you're a rambler. You might both wish you hadn't."
Bo had finished paring his nails. He shut the knife with a snick and put it in his pocket.
"You're an old busybody," he said. "Why don't you go back and tend to your store?"
Carl shrugged and pushed himself away from the bar.
"Give me a beer first."
While Bo got out a bottle and glass, Carl watched him. He was a nice guy. He was a hell of a nice guy. But what kind of a life would it be for that innocent of an Elsa, tagging him around from one thing to another? Bo wasn't a sticker. He chased rainbows too much.
"You really gone on her?" he said. "You going to become a reformed character and settle down and be an alderman?"
Bo scraped the foam from Carl's glass with an ivory stick and dropped the bottle in a box under the bar. A man across the room was pulling the handle of the slot machine.
"I told him,"
somebody back by the pool table said loudly,
"that I'd cut it for fodder before I'd pay any such cut to a thrashing crew."
"Look," Bo said, "how many times do I have to tell you? I want to marry her. I'm not pretending to be something I'm not, but I'm not saying I'm going on here sitting on my tail in this little joint either. If she wants to marry me on those terms, whose business is it but hers and mine? Write her old man and tell him anything you please. I'll write him myself if you want. I'm not trying to pull any fast ones. Sure, she's a nice girl. She's so nice I can't believe it, considering the way she was brought up. She's a peach. She deserves a lot. I know it. I want to try to give it to her."
"Yeah," Carl said. "Well, nobody could ask for more than that. I wasn't trying to break it up, you understand. It was just that I got this letter."
He stopped. Bo was looking past him toward the man by the slot machine against the far wall. Moving swiftly, he raised the board and stepped out from behind the bar. He was almost at the man's shoulder before the other heard him and turned. He was a tall, loosely built man, a bum or an itinerant laborer with a ragged elbow in his coat. He turned and squawked almost in the same instant, and then Bo collared him. Elsa looked up from the letter with puckered brows, looked unhappily out the window. It was a gray, unpleasant day, and the wind blew, rattling the window frame. The tight-lipped, strained face of her mother looked at her from the German silver frame of the daguerreotype. She felt miserable and discontented, and she hadn't seen Bo for days. Hardanger, her uncle's house, the people she knew here, were a foreign land and a foreign people. She had cut herself off from home, and now there was no real home here. Her eyes went back to the letter. Sarah, Kristen wrote, was pretty hard to get along with sometimes. She was funny. One minute she'd be apologetic and let Erling run all over her and act as if she were a stray that had been let in, and the next she'd be snappish, trying to run the whole place. And she agreed with Pa that something should be done about Elsa before she flew off the handle and married some good-for-nothing. Who was Bo Mason, anyway? Pa seemed to be worried about him. Was he nice? Where had she met him? Elsa stood up. Let him think what he pleased. He would think the worst, because that was the way he was. But that didn't bother her. She knew Bo a lot better than he did, and if she chose to marry him, and were asked, she would.
And what right had Sarah to talk, marrying a man twice as old as she was, and then presuming to dictate the marriages of other people? Angrily the girl threw on her coat and went outside. Until 5 in the afternoon she walked as fast as her legs would carry her, out through flattened, weedy fields, across strips of summer fallow, over the corner of the dump ground among wheels of old buggies, pieces of scrap iron, papers, tin cans rusted and plugged with bullet holes from the target shooting of boys, the bones of a cow gnawed by dogs or coyotes. The slough confronted her, a saucer of stagnant water rimmed with tules, with mud hens floating close to shore and a wary flock of canvasbacks swimming out in the open water. She walked clear around it, feeling through her coat the coming of deep fall. The going away of warmth from the earth was like some loss of warmth and energy in herself. And Kristen, wanting to get away from home too, asking if there wasn't someone in Hardanger who needed a girl. Kristen, who couldn't bake, couldn't clean house without leaving the corners full of dust puppies and the wallpaper smeared where her broom had brushed down cobwebs. Indian Falls, the place she had called home and still unconsciously thought of as home, must be as bad as she had thought when she left, if Chris wanted to leave too. But the sister she wanted to come to was lonesome in a strange and barren town. Her feet kicked in flat brown reeds, sank in muck, squashed through wet hummocks of meadow, found dry ground again. How long would she go on living in someone else's house, eating someone else's bread, with never anything to call her own except the clothes she wore and the thoughts she thought? It would be nice, she thought irrationally, to take piano lessons. But there wasn't a piano in any house open to her. There wasn't anything she could do, no way she could use her time to improve herself, except by reading, and even finding books was difficult. She kicked a pebble down the ruts worn by the dump wagons. "What's the matter with you?" she said, and impatience put length in her strides again, mooning around like a calf, wishing you were somewhere else, or somebody else, and wanting things you can't have. "But I know what I want," she said. "I want a place of my own where I can sit down and everything there is mine and everything I do means something." "And you want Bo in it," she said. "Well, what if I do?" she answered. Her feet found plank sidewalk under them. She was on the prairie end of Main Street. At the confectionery she hesitated. An ice cream soda might be nice. But the wind whipping around the corner changed her mind. A cup of coffee at home would be better. She hurried faster. The fogged sun had gone completely, and the wind had a bite. It was too bad, she thought, as she neared the bowling alley, that Bo didn't run a place women could go to. She would have liked to drop in sometimes. She would like to right now, and see why he hadn't been over. But then he would think she was chasing him. With her head down against the wind, she went past his door. She was half a dozen steps past when she heard the uproar inside and Bo's voice saying, "All right. I'll just fix you so you won't be tempted again." She shrank back into her uncle's doorway just as the swinging doors of the pool hall burst open and Bo, holding a man by the front of his coat, pushed him through and backed him to the edge of the sidewalk. Though the stranger was almost as big as Bo, he looked beaten. There was a ragged hole in the elbow of his coat. The crowd that had poured out after them stood in a cluster on the sidewalk. Elsa saw Carl still in his store apron and his black sateen cuff protectors. "Now," Bo said, "how many times did you slug that machine?" The man's quick eyes shifted from Bo to the crowd and back. He wet his lips. "I'll make it good, mister," he said. His hand fumbled in his pocket. "How many times?"
"Just once."
The tramp's hands quit fumbling, came up to lie lightly on Bo's wrist.
"That guy was right close, he can tell you. I only did it once. I was hungry and needed a cup of coffee."
"Why didn't you ask for a cup of coffee?"
"I didn't think you'd hand it out, mister. Honest to God, I'll make it good."
He almost babbled, his eyes on Bo's heavy, dark face. It was so changed a face from his usual one that Elsa felt her stomach draw in. Bo kept his left hand rigid on the man's coat, teetering him on the 18-inch drop-off into the street.
Well, turnabout's fair play. That's right, isn't it? Even Stephen?
Beau said softly.
That's all I'm going to slug, you see. Only once.
The crowd snickered, then someone grunted, a startled sound, as Beau's right fist smashed up. The tramp toppled backward into the street and lay where he fell, with a smear of blood on his mouth and his hat 10 feet away from him in the dust. Beau swung to go back inside, pushing through the men whose eyes still fed on the man lying in the street. Then he saw Elsa, flattened against her uncle's door. His expression changed. The hard, tough look left his face, and he took 2 steps toward her, but before he could come any further, she turned and ran. She did not look back, but she heard the windy whoosh of the swinging doors as someone went through then, and the voice of someone in the crowd. "Jesus," the voice said. "I'll just slug you once," he says, and then he socks him. "Turnabout's fair play," he says. Elsa, hurrying home with her stomach sick and her mind hot with outrage, saw nothing. Her mind was too full of the image of the fear-stricken face of the tramp and the abrupt stillness of his body in the street and the smear of blood on his mouth. He had been hit when he was begging for mercy, when he was making no attempt to resist, when he was offering to make good whatever it was he had done. Any man with a bit of pity in him would have let him go. Too furious to think, she went and sat on her bed upstairs, stooped to run icy hands through the mass of her hair. Quite suddenly, not knowing she was going to do it, she began to cry. He appeared so suddenly that there was no way to avoid him. It was 8 o'clock. She had finished the supper dishes and was sweeping the kitchen, aware of the pipe smell from the parlor where Carl was reading, aware dimly that it had started to drizzle outside, and that she ought to shut the kitchen door. But she finished sweeping first, stooping with the dustpan, and when she rose he was in the doorway, rain dripping from the curled brim of his derby and the shoulders of his coat dark with wet. For a moment she confronted him, dustpan in hand, as if he had been a burglar. He leaned against the jamb and said nothing, but his eyes were steady and his face serious. There was no trace around his mouth of the toughness she had seen that afternoon. She looked for it in the instant she faced him, but it was his nice face she saw, the smooth skin, dark and healthy-looking, the jaw square, the gray eyes lighted with somber warmth. She dropped her eyes to his hand, the hand that had been a brutal fist that afternoon, hooked in his lapel, a square, brown hand with long, square-ended fingers, a strong, heavy wrist. With a twist of his body, he straightened away from the jam. "Hello," he said.
"Hello," she said.
She stepped to the door, brushing him as she went by, and dumped the dustpan in the can, came back and shut the door, folded the tablecloth, and put it away. "I thought I'd better come over," he said.
"Oh?"
"I thought maybe I ought to do a little explaining." "Is there anything to explain?" "There's plenty to explain. You saw me hit that guy."
She faced him then, furiously.
"Yes, I saw you hit him. I saw you hit him when he wasn't fighting back and was begging you not to." Annoyance brushed his face, was smoothed away again. His voice was quiet, as if he were maintaining his patience and explaining something to a child.
"There's only one way you can treat those guys," he said.
"He said he'd pay you back for whatever it was he did."
"Sure, sure. He'd pay me back long as I had him. And you know what he'd do? Next place he went into, he'd slug some other machine. Guys like that will go on slugging machines till someone shows them it isn't healthy."
"I suppose you did it just to teach him a lesson."
Beau flushed. Leaning against the door, he breathed through his nose, pressing his lips together. She couldn't keep her temper now. She had to tell him what she thought of him.
"What if he did slug a machine?" she said. "It's a gambling thing, isn't it?"
"Sort of."
She took her hands from her apron pockets, shoved them back in again hard because she couldn't keep them from shaking.
"Remember what you told me at the carnival?" she said. "Remember what you said about it was all right to take advantage of a gambling game because any game like that was crooked?
Any gambling game is crooked. Judd said so himself. What that tramp did was just what you and Judd did when you both threw at once.
It isn't the same, Bo said. It isn't anything like the same.
I don't see any difference. You bullied the man at the carnival when he objected. What if the tramp had bullied you the same way?
He'd have got his head knocked off.
He did anyway.
Elsa opened her hands inside her pockets. They were sweating in the palms.
I explained to you, Bo said. You let these guys get away with things like that, and they'll cheat everybody up and down the line.
She couldn't see him anymore because her eyes were blurry.
That was the most brutal thing I ever saw, she said.
He did not speak for a moment, but when he did, his voice was rougher.
You shouldn't have been around there, he said. That's a man's place. It's no place for a woman.
She looked at him, almost stammering.
Excuse me, she said. I didn't know the sidewalks were someplace I shouldn't go. But I suppose you have to have them clear so you can beat somebody up every once in a while.
Listen, Elsa.
Listen, nothing! I thought you were big and strong and fine, and now I find out that all you use your strength for is to hit people who beg you not to. If you'd shown any mercy at all, the least bit of pity,
just because I sock a damn tin horn that slugs my machine, I'm that bad.
You're worse.
He laughed, the short, choppy, contemptuous sound that meant he was disgusted.
All right, he said briefly. That's the way you feel about it. He pulled down his derby and ducked out into the drizzle.
Very slowly the fury drained out of her. Weakness wobbled her knees. She sat down at the table and bit her knuckles and stared at the wall. After a while she picked up the lamp and made her way through the parlor past Carl, who looked up with a discreet question in his eyes that she ignored.
Chapter 7
Helm stood spraddle-legged, resting her weight evenly on both feet before the kitchen table she was using for an ironing board. The room was full of the smell of steam and starch. Helm's great bare arm, solid as a saw log, moved with weight and authority back and forth, and her tongue moved just as heavily, just as authoritatively, with the same kind of bludgeoning dislike.
"Now this," she said, "is the shirt of Mr. Gerald Whitwer, the druggist. Look at it. French flannel, fine enough to wrap a baby in. Summertimes he wears silk and madras. His old lady never sends his underwear, and there are only two possible reasons why. Either she don't want to give away that he wears silk panties, or he can't hang on to himself, and she's ashamed to send them with the wash. I don't know which choice I'd rather take. Maybe both."
She finished the shirt and folded it onto the pile in the basket.
"Sometimes," she said, "I think I'd rather sit out in front of Bo's pool hall with a patch over my eye and a tin cup strapped on my leg than wash the dirt out of clothes for people like them. Even when they're clean, those clothes are dirty. There's some kinds of hypocritical dirt you can't get out."
Elsa was only half listening. She sat by the window looking out, thinking that fall wasn't the pleasant season here that it was at home. There weren't any trees to change, for one thing. The land just got brown and then gray, and one night it froze, and then it rained and froze again, so that the roads were ridged with hardened tracks, and every change from summer to winter made the place look more desolate than it had before. And the wind blew interminably, holding you back, hustling you along, sweeping at you from around corners. You weren't free of it even inside, for it whined in the eave spouts and slammed doors and eddied down the chimney and made the stove smoke. It kept you tense all the time. The realization that Helm had stopped speaking made her look up. Helm was watching her, smiling with her blackened teeth, her eyes soft and shining.
"Honey," Helm said, "ain't you made it up with Bo yet?"
Elsa shook her head.
"Ain't you going to?"
Elsa shook her head again.
"I didn't like you to hold a grudge," Helm said.
"It isn't a grudge," Elsa said. "I just can't like him after what he did."
"Well, what did he do?" Helm said. "He knocked down a tramp that had slugged a slot machine. That isn't anything to break your heart over, honey.
If you try to find a man that never knocked another man down, you're going to be left with nothing but guys like Gerald Whitwer to pick from. I'd rather have one that could knock somebody else down, even if he had to do it once in a while to keep in practice.
He did it in cold blood, Elsa said stubbornly.
That was what... Bo hasn't got a drop of cold blood in him, Helm said. Tell me he's got too wild a temper and gets disgusted too quick and despises people if they're clumsy or puny or hypocritical. But don't tell me he's cold-blooded.
He was that day. I saw him.
Helm released the catch and dropped a sadiron into the stove. Picked up another, upended it, spat on the smooth bottom.
Well, it sure hasn't helped your disposition, either one of you, she said. You mope around like you didn't care whether you lit butter side up or down. And Bo goes snarling around the place like a dog that's been kicked around too much and is going to bite the next guy tries it. Why don't you call it quits and give your friends a rest?
I'm sorry, Elsa said, and rose. I don't want to be grumpy and bad company. It's the darn weather. I never saw weather stay so gray and disagreeable. I never could be cheerful in bad weather.
Honey, the big woman said, you're talking right through the top of your hat.
But Helm didn't know everything, Elsa thought on the way home. She hadn't seen Bo hit that man. Besides, Helm, for all her big heart, was used to rough men. She thought a man ought to be rough, but he oughtn't. A man could be strong and full of courage and still be generous and kind. "But what on earth shall I do?" she said, and looked with distaste at the weedy, vacant lot she was passing. While she had been dreaming her idiotic dreams about Bo Mason, Hardanger had been a vivid and exciting place, but now that those were put away, it was a dreary little village on the desolate flats, and the only people she knew in it were in some way tied up with Bo, the Whitwers and the Shantzes and the more respectable part of town kept to itself. There wasn't a friend to make the place bearable except those friends who were also friends of Bo's, and she never went to Helm's anymore without dreading to find him there. She heard the train whistle forlornly as she turned in at Carl's house. She felt as lonely as the train sounded, but inside the hall she took off her coat almost angrily. What she needed was work. If she didn't do something, she'd be pitying herself until she blubbered. When she went to the kitchen and started in, she found the four mallards on the table. There was no note with them, but she knew instantly who had brought them. Carl never went hunting. Neither did Judd. There was only one other person who would have left them. Well, she thought, if he thinks he can wheedle me out of it that way. But that was the second thing that came into her mind. The first was pleasure. The very sight of the ducks lying there and the instant recognition of their giver was a pure, warm pleasure. 3 days later, when she opened the front door to sweep the first dry snow of the year off the porch, there were four more ducks hanging on the doorknob. They had not been there more than a few minutes, for their webbed feet were barely stiff, and the bodies of the ducks when she plucked them were still faintly warm. The tracks that led to and from the porch were large tracks, the imprints corrugated like the rubber sole of a wader boot. Carl raised his eyebrows when he saw her plucking the second batch of birds, but she gave him no explanation. There wasn't any explanation she could give him. She told herself that she was not softening one bit, that he could go on leaving ducks as long as he chose, and she would not change her mind about him. Still, she looked at both front and kitchen door every morning to see if anything else was there. On the Sunday following the first mallards, there was a great Canada goose.
"Don't you think we ought to have company for supper?" Carl said. "If this buck Indian or whoever he is keeps leaving game in front of the wigwam, we ought at least to let him come and eat some of it, hadn't we?"
Elsa was on the point of saying yes and letting her anger and her dislike evaporate, but when she looked up into Carl's little knowing round blue eyes, she shook her head.
"I'd rather not, Uncle Carl."
He shrugged and let it go. And after he had left for the store, she wondered if Bo had put him up to that question. It would be just like him, and then he could come swaggering in on her invitation. If she made the first move, then his pride would be saved. But the first move had already been made, she reminded herself, and he had made it. "Oh, I don't know," she said in vexation, and stormed through the house, doing her housework as if every pillow were a face to be slapped. "He did hit that man in cold blood," she said, but she couldn't fix the image of the sprawling body and the bloody mouth as definitely as she would have liked. Beau's eyes kept coming in over it, gray and steady and somberly warm, and once during the morning she found herself mentally molding the blunt angle of his jaw, almost as if she were running her fingers along it. The post office was at the far end of town, a frame shanty with a wall of boxes and a stamp window. Within the past 2 weeks the winter stove had been set up in the center of the room, and a great pile of lignite dumped against the back wall outside. There were almost always two or three men sitting around on the bench, because on these cold days the post office was snug. Elsa found herself anticipating that hot, tobacco-smelling cubbyhole as she walked through the light snow. Even the few blocks walk from Carl's house could redden her nose and whiten her breath these days. She walked fast, noticing that all the houses were banked with dirt or had tar paper tacked along the foundations. The smokes from all the chimneys had a warm, intimate look, and the town seemed friendlier now that its ugly, weed-grown lots were covered with snow. There were stubby icicles hanging from the eaves of the post office. She was not thinking about Beau at all when she opened the door and stepped in. If she had been, she might have been better prepared. As it was, she stopped dead still just inside the door, with her hand still on the knob. "Morning," he said. A swift look showed her no one else in the room except old Mr. Blake, puttering in the room behind the window. "Hello," she said briefly, and went to Carl's box. He was right behind her. She felt his presence with a kind of stage fright. "Look," he said. She took the one white envelope from the box, her mind automatically registering that it was from Indian Falls, in her father's spidery old-world hand, and with the letter held helplessly in her fingers, she looked. His eyes were so sober, so warm, so compelling, that she was confused. She ought to walk right on out, bid him good morning, and open the door. "Call it quits," Beau said. Her confusion deepened. He was too direct and blunt. She fought the blood back from her face. "I'll apologize," he said. "I'll admit I was wrong, if that's what you want." "That wouldn't make it good to the poor man you hit," she said. "I already made that good."
"You did?"
"As much as I could. I took him in and fed him and gave him money to get out of town."
"When?"
"Right after I saw you down there, right after it happened."
"But you didn't tell me," she said.
"You never gave me a chance."
"I—"
Elsa said again. "I still think there's only one way to treat a tin horn," Beau said. "But after the way you looked, I got worrying about him and went out and brought him in. I guess maybe I was already mad when I spotted him. Carl had been giving me the curry comb for a half hour."
"What about?"
she said curiously. She couldn't imagine Carl doing anything of the kind. "You."
"Me?"
"You," Beau said. "He'd got a letter from your father telling him to get you out of my clutches."
"Oh,"
Elsa said furiously. She turned half away from his intent stare. The letter in her fingers was like a match held too long. She looked at it, wanting to drop it as she would have dropped the match before it burned her, but she did not drop it. When she looked up, Beau was looking at it too. "That another one from him?" he said. She nodded. "Kind of upset, isn't he?" he said, and laughed. In spite of her rage, she had to laugh with him.
"Sometimes," she said, "I could—" "He made me a little mad myself," Beau said.
"I guess I took it out on that bum.
Shall we call it quits?"
Elsa looked into his face, dark and square, a little curl of smile at the corners of his mouth, his eyes smoky and glowing.
"All right," she said. She shook her head. "Everything is such a mess," she said.
Beau held up his hand, and she saw that he too had a letter. He was grinning.
Between your family and mine, he said, we've got a nice combination.
Your family? She said. I didn't know you ever heard from your family.
She craned to read the return address in the corner of the envelope. Hattie Mason, Black Hawk, Illinois.